Hello, I'm Donna Edwards, and thank you for joining us today. This is Woman to Woman, Let's Talk Leadership. As a woman of color and former member of Congress, I'm talking with women of color leaders at every level. What inspires them? What motivates them? What makes today's leaders lead? Currently, I'm a fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice, and I'm grateful for the Brennan Center's support in the production of this series. You can find more about our work online at brennancenter.org. That's B-R-E-N-N-A-N, center.org. And we'll be posting our programs on iTunes, on YouTube, and on all the multimedia section of the website, so there's no way to miss us. Well, our hope today is to inspire people of all backgrounds, especially women, to take on leadership role in their communities. And joining me in the studio today, I'm so excited about this, is Washington, D.C. Here in Washington, D.C., is Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal. She represents the state of Washington. That's the other Washington 7th Congressional District, which encompasses most of the city of Seattle and some surrounding areas. She's the first Indian American woman in the House of Representatives, and she spent her career advocating for women's, immigrant, civil, and human rights. And in 2013, Jayapal was recognized by President Obama as White House Champion of Change. Welcome to my good friend, Pramila Jayapal.
Thank you.
Congresswoman.
It is so good to be here with you.
Well, tell us a little bit about you, about, you know, where you grew up mm-hmm. and kind of what brings you to leadership. Mm-hmm.
Well, I was born in India, and I came to the United States when I was 16 years old by myself. My parents had about $5,000 in their bank account, and they used every penny of it to send me here by myself because they felt like this was the place I was going to get the best education and have the most opportunity. And I was always grateful to them, but I don't think I was fully grateful enough. I don't think I recognized the sacrifice until my son turned 16. And I thought about, you know, what that meant to send your kid across the ocean, know that they might never come back. And in fact, that's what happened because it took me 17 years to get my U.S. citizenship, by which time it was too late for them to move and start a whole new life in another country, you know, to be able to sponsor them to come here as my parents. So incredibly grateful to them. And, you know, and I think that my experience growing up all over the world and working all over the world has informed how I see my job here in Congress, but really how I see our collective kind of humanity and how we legislate around that.
Well, I want to ask you about that because I think, for example, in Congress and in the country, there's been a lot of focus and attention around immigration reform and what it means to be an immigrant. And when people talk about the United States being a nation of immigrants and a place for opportunity, your story and your life story really is a testament to that.
Yeah, it feels like an incredible moment to be here because, you know, I think I'm one of only maybe a dozen members of Congress who were born outside of the United States. And in a time when this president has come to office, you know, really sort of demonizing immigrants and so much of, you know, our history is complicated around immigration. But it's not like we've always welcomed immigrants either. But I think that there has been this push-pull, love-hate relationship. Now, most Americans recognize that immigrants are good for this country. And unless you're Native American, you either came over on slave ships, your ancestors came over on slave ships, and you were forced to come here, or you came here to escape. But everybody's ancestors came from somewhere else. And so trying to make that connection again, I think, in Congress is really important, and trying to bring humanity to real stories and talking about it because it is personal, but it's also collective to who we are. I've always said immigration, the issues around immigration are not really about immigration. They're about who we are as a country and what we're willing to stand up for. And I think my experience, both as an immigrant personally, but then also as an immigrant rights activist and advocate for the last 15 years, means that I'm very well steeped in the immigration system, how it works, and how we should fix it for the better, not for the worse.
Well, so I've been really interested in this idea of what it is that brings you to leadership, and especially what brings women to leadership, because I think it's a different pathway. And, you know, they say that a woman has to be asked like seven times before she decides to run for office. How many times did someone have to ask you?
More than seven. You know, but mainly it was because I always felt like I was better on the outside. I was an activist. I was involved in civil disobedience. I've been arrested a couple of times before coming to Congress. And I really saw my role as being sort of to push the bounds of what's possible on the outside. But what I realized after 15 years of doing that, I, you know, founded and started what is now the largest immigrant advocacy organization in Washington state, one of the largest in the country. We successfully sued the Bush administration around deportation of Somalis across the country, fought for the DREAM Act in our own state, you know, did a lot of amazing things. But I realized that all the people that I was trying to convince, many of them really wonderful people, did not look like me, did not have my experience. I felt incredibly underrepresented in many ways and felt like I had to start the explanations from so far back just to get people to the right place. And I thought, you know, why are we as organizers ceding the political territory of elected office? Why is it that we only organize on what's called the outside? But why aren't we on the inside organizing? And why aren't we bringing our years of experience advocating for communities to these elected positions? And so I decided to run for the state Senate a couple of years ago. I became the only woman of color in the state Senate. People think of Washington State as a very progressive place, but there was one woman of color in the state Senate. I was the first Indian American to be elected to state office. And now, you know, as the first Indian American woman, as you said, in the U.S. House, but also the first person of color in the Washington Democratic delegation to Congress. So, you know, we have some work to do here.
Well, I always like to say 2017, it seems amazing that there are so many firsts still.
I know.
And so,
and they can't be the last, as you know. So many people were inspired by you in Congress. And I think that that has to be our role, is to really build those leadership ladders and recognize that they come in many different forms, that there isn't a specific path to elected office or to leadership, but that you can take leadership in one arena and apply it to another arena, which I feel like is what I've been doing.
Well, now. So you've talked about your life coming to the United States as a 16-year-old. I still can't actually picture that because, yeah. You know, when you think about parents, and I know this has been said, especially in the recent immigration fight, that a parent who just sends their child alone by themselves because they want that child to have opportunity. I'm the parent of a now 29-year-old, and it's really tough to imagine doing that. And so you've had your experiences as an immigrant child that mm-hmm. affects your leadership.
Yeah.
You've had an experience as an organizer, an activist, a litigator mm-hmm. That impacts your leadership. And tell me about Congress. So you arrive in Congress, and it's also a place that, you know, isn't as representative
yes.
as we laugh at that.
Yes.
What's your experience been in the Congress?
Well, you know, this is such an unusual time. I don't know what it was like before Donald Trump, but I got into Congress, and in my first week, you know, I was one of the 8 or 9 people that challenged the Electoral College results on the floor. I was shut down by Joe Biden and along with others. I boycotted the inauguration because I said I wanted to be at home with undocumented immigrants and people who were afraid by this presidency. And that felt just as important to me as going to the inauguration. So I had sort of a start that required me to put my moral convictions on the table right away. And that's not unusual for me in general, but, you know, I wouldn't have anticipated doing that had we had another president, had we had Hillary Clinton as our president. And so I've had a really good experience there. I am the first vice chair of the Progressive Caucus. So along with Mark Pocan and Raul Grijalva, really trying to, make the Progressive Caucus as powerful a force as it can be. I think it's the right time for that. I'm on the Judiciary Committee, so I'm dealing directly with issues of criminal justice, immigration reform, things that I've worked on for a very long time. I ran for and was elected as vice-ranking member of the Budget Committee, which is a new position, and it's been a great opportunity for me to learn about the budget and to be able to talk about a whole bunch of things that matter. I feel like the organizing platform that I ran on is so important today. The reason we've defeated Trump Care 3 times is because millions of Americans across the country have been in the streets and on the phones and in congressional offices and saying, no, we're not going to let you take our health care away. And so it's been as horrible as this moment is, I, as an organizer, think that strength emerges in times of crisis and that this is an organizing opportunity for us. You know, somebody said the other day to me, how do you feel in the era of Trump? And I said, this is not the era of Trump. This is the era of the people, you know, and we have to take back our democracy. So it's been a whirlwind. I can't believe we're coming up on a year and I'm going to have to run for reelection again. But I feel like every day I go in and it's consequential and I know what I'm trying to do. I know what I have to do. I know that the things that I want for our country only are going to happen if we get more people involved in democracy. And I feel like that's a big part of my job, is using this platform to lift up different stories, different voices, inspire people to be involved, inspire people to run for office themselves, endorsing a whole plank of candidates that are all up and down the spectrum in terms of what office they're running for, but women, folks of color, young people.
Well, I as I listen to you, I remember times when I was in Congress and people would say, well, what law did you pass? And you're reminding me that Congress isn't just about what law you pass. It's about how you organize around issues that are important to
right.
people, what you do in your congressional
right.
district, and obviously the bad things that you might stop.
No, exactly. I was just saying to somebody the other day, if you were somebody who believed that your primary task in Congress was to pass legislation, it would be incredibly frustrating because in this partisan environment, even things that Republicans say to me, I totally agree with you on that, they still won't come out and vote for it or put it forward or talk about it publicly. That's not true of everybody, but, you know, for the most part. And so this is, and when you're in the minority, as you know, you have to use backdoor channels to get stuff done, budget appropriations, riders, you know, amendments, that kind of thing. It's very difficult to pass a substantive bill on the issues that we all care about. But we cannot just be an opposition party. We do have to be an opposition party as Democrats in the minority. And there's so much to oppose right now, it's mind-boggling. But we can't just be an opposition party. We also have to be a proposition party. And we have to say what we stand for and inspire people to trust us and to believe in us and to want to be engaged.
Well, so how does that, when you step back from the day-to-day politics and think about the people in your district and the kinds of things that they want you to do. Don't you hear folks say all the time, we just want you to get along? And how do you use your leadership to demonstrate to your constituents that your work in the Congress, even as a Democrat, is important, but trying to find common ground?
I have things that, you know, I have worked with the other side on that I will bring up when people say that, including immigration. Actually, I'm co-chairing a group of six Democrats, new members, and six Republican new members on immigration. Just wrote an article with Roger Marshall from Kansas, a bipartisan op-ed on the need for immigration reform. But I also will challenge people on this whole idea of, you know, well, can't you just compromise? Because, and I give them the example of healthcare. I say, okay, you want me to compromise? You know, the Republicans wanted to strip healthcare from 23 million. We didn't want to strip healthcare from anyone. Would you like me to compromise on 15 million or, you know, 12 million? And people are like, no, not that kind of compromise. And so just really having people think a little bit about, it's a human reaction to want to have people get along. But I think that gets responded to in our vision by talking about love. I talk about love a lot as part of my leadership.
Love. Now,
model.
So that's a different kind of
yes.
leadership strategy.
It
Tell
is.
Me about that.
Well, I really believe that that's what people are looking for. It's what I'm looking for in my life. Not just, you know, personal love, but collective love, a society that takes care of each other. You know, I've always said that I live by this very simple phrase that we're all better off when we're all better off. And we can help each other. And if you think about big programs like Social Security, it's this idea that I'm going to put money in and it's going to take care of you when you get old, and you're going to put money in, and it's going to take care of me when I get old. And we're helping each other because we believe that we're in community together. And so I find that when I talk about love in speeches and things like that, people almost don't know what to do. They're like, wow, that's a politician talking about love. But they are so moved by it. And I think it just reminds us of who we are as human beings. And so that's how I get to this idea of, can't we all get along? Because in the vision, we should be caring for each other, and we should be fighting against anything or standing up against anything that somehow stereotypes, dismisses people as not being worthy of that opportunity. You know, the opportunity that I got to come here as an immigrant. Everybody should have that. The American dream isn't real for so many people. And so I think when you recognize that, but you do it in a way that not only calls people out, you do have to call people out sometimes, but also calls people in, I think that we end up as a much better place. And my district loves it that I'm on the forefront of, you know, fighting the resistance, but also organizing and also proposing a different kind of a vision.
Well, you know, as you began to discuss this idea of how it is that you build and rebuild community, because that's what you're talking about, that it requires a particular kind of skills.
Yeah.
And so walk me back through the skills that you've gained over now a lifetime of experience that bring you to this point.
Well, this is one of the things that young people love hearing me talk about, because they're like, wow, you didn't have a straight line at all. I'm like, no. When your immigrant parents take their last dollar and send you to the United States, it's because they want you to be a doctor, a lawyer, or an engineer. Those were the three acceptable professions. And my sophomore year of college, we had one phone call home a
year.
And
where did you go to
college? I went to Georgetown University. We had one phone call home a year because we just couldn't afford any. There was no Skype or anything. So I used my one phone call my sophomore year to call my dad and tell him that I was going to be an English literature major instead of an economics major.
And that sounds like a conversation that I had with my dad, because as you know, in African-American families,
yes,
as well, if the one child gets to go to college,
exactly,
an engineer, a lawyer,
something,
or a doctor,
that makes money,
not
right?
An English major.
You were an English major.
I was.
I knew I liked you for all kinds of reasons. Here's another one. And so, you know the story. Hold the phone away from my ear. My dad screams at me and says, I didn't send you to the United States to learn how to speak English. You already know how to speak English. And so I promised him I'd get the same job with an English degree that I would have with an economics degree. I went on to work on Wall Street. I learned financial skills. I do think communication skills, written and oral, are so important, and they allow us to be articulate when we have a public platform, right? And which is really important in Congress. So those communication skills, I think my business, organizational, and management skills, I got a master's in business, it really, really important to running a nonprofit organization, but then also to being able to run an effective congressional office. And then I also think that, you know, there's just a whole host of other things. I did a sales job for a year out of business school. I was the only woman of color. I was selling defibrillators in Western Ohio and Eastern Indiana. And I'll tell you, I learned so much about sales that was helpful to me when in fundraising for Congress, in, you know, raising money for my nonprofit. But I also learned how to talk to people who are really, really different than me. I mean, in Indiana, there were, you know, I would go into these little volunteer fire departments and people would say, where are you from? And I'd say, India. And they'd look at me and say, where in Indiana? And I was like, no, not Indiana, India, like the country, you know, across the ocean. And we didn't have a lot in common, but we found a lot in common. You know, we didn't have a lot in common politically, I should say, but we found a lot in common as human beings. And I ended up doing really well as a sales rep, stayed long enough to show the guys that I could beat them on their sales records, and then was like, okay, I'm done with this. So, and then, you know, as an advocate and an activist, I think really grounding myself in what was important to me, because, you know, you come to Congress and there are things that can feel very heady and you can do a whole bunch of things that don't really feel quite right to you if you're not deeply grounded in what you're fighting for. And I feel like I you know, I'm 51 years old, proud of it, and happy to have had experiences my whole life that have taught me what's really important to fight for. And so I think all of those skills and this very circuitous route that I've had to getting to Congress has been incredibly helpful. And I would just say to people who are out there, you know, your leadership doesn't have to be confined to the place that you started leadership or that you're in leadership. It is transferable. You just have to think about what is transferable in those skills and then be willing to kind of, you know, harness and seize, particularly for women of color. We don't do this very often, but harness and seize that opportunity to show that you can be a leader in a different field.
Well, it does strike me, of course, that, and I describe this all the time to young people because they think that you have to run for one political office to run for another political
right.
office
exactly.
to run for another political yep. office and end up in Congress. And really what you've described is that you have a very windy path up and down, and
yeah.
it's not a highway. It's
right.
more like, you know, a country road.
Yeah. Exactly.
And that brings you to leadership in a different kind of way.
Yeah, exactly. And I also, you know, I tell a lot of, because there's a lot of people who want to run for office now, particularly in this moment in the country's history. And you know, they often come to me, and sometimes they're very young and will say, you know, what do? I want to run for office. And I will say to them, and I actually stole this from John Sarbanes. I heard him say it, and it's really articulated how I feel. You know, I'll say to them, don't think about what you want to be. Think about what you want to do. And it's more important to go out and do things in the issues that you care about, issue areas that you care about in your community. Get to know people. Because I found when I ran for Congress, and I think you had this experience too, I knew so many people by the time I ran for Congress. I was not introducing myself to people for the first time, you know, whether it was people in the progressive community, the labor community, the women's rights community. That had been my work. So nobody really had to say, well, I'm not sure if she's going to stand for what she believes in, or should we endorse her? It was like I got the endorsements almost instantaneously from everybody. And so I don't think it, again, I think it's a windy road in some ways, and in other ways, if you look at it, maybe it's the better straight path to getting to elected office. You know what I mean? Because you're so deeply ensconced in the community that you've built the relationships you need to build before you run, so that you can get there.
Well, I always say the work that I did in nonprofit advocacy and foundation work, all of that was exactly the kind of preparation that I needed for Congress. The other part of my preparation, I don't know about yours, was being a mom.
Totally.
And, you know,
hardest thing I've ever done.
So tell me about that.
Well, you know, my son, I have two, actually. I have one son who's 20, and then I have a 38-year-old stepson. And my son was born very, very early, 26 and a half weeks. He was 1 pound, 14 ounces when he was born. He was born in India. He almost died. He really shouldn't be here, but he is a total miracle boy. And just going through that experience was the hardest thing I've ever done, hands down. And it was very traumatic, and I went through a lot of stuff, and I came out, I think, stronger for it. But then, you know, growing up with and growing a young man in today's world to be a feminist, a racial justice, you know, racially justice conscious young man, and then learning so much from this generation. I mean, he's taught me so much about how this generation looks at things very differently from other generations. And I think, you know, understands intersectionality in a way that doesn't really require the word. We have to use the word all the time because nobody understands.
And they live it.
They live it. And so they don't even think about, you know, they don't even think about these things separately. And it matters for our organizing tactics, because where you used to have organizations that had membership, right? You have a member, you're the member of the ACLU or whatever. Today, I think people are interested in multiple issues. And whatever opportunities we have for engagement and organizing need to be geared towards people wanting to work on multiple things at one time. So, yes, I'm an immigrant rights advocate and I want to go out and fight against the Muslim ban, but I also want to make sure I'm fighting on trans issues and LGBT issues. And by the way, you know, minimum wage matters to me. And so we need to have much more seamless means of engaging people and allowing them to move between different issues, because I think that's like the best cross-pollination we can have to build a truly intersectional movement. And I think that they get it in a way that is just so remarkably wonderful.
And so your son has taught you that and is teaching you that.
Yeah, I mean, it's always something I've had in my concept of intersectionality. I always say as a woman of color, an immigrant woman of color, it's not like I'm a mom on Monday, an immigrant on Tuesday, a worker on Wednesday, and, you know, whatever on Thursday. I'm all of those things all of the time, and I'm going to fight for all of those things all of the time. But in terms of how we engage and organize young people, you know, I think I got 70% of the millennial vote in my election, even though I was running against somebody who was 31 years old. But I think it's because, you know, young people today, they want boldness. They want a vision. They want to have somebody that touches on a number of different issues and understands how they all go together and gives them opportunities for leadership. And I've always said that, you know, we've run a lot of leadership programs over the years, and I always say we don't create leaders. We just provide the space that allows for leadership to emerge. And I think that's what we have to continue to provide this generation.
Well, so I just want to remind our listeners, we're here today with Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal, who's from Washington's 7th District. I'm Donna Edwards, and we are two women, woman to woman, talking leadership. And, you know, I was thinking as you've been describing both your work and your history, that there are things out there that people don't know about members of Congress. They don't think that we do our own, I would say we, because I was a member
yes.
of the club, your own grocery shopping, and that you pump
Isn't
gas
that funny?
And all of that.
I know. I find that so funny, Donna. I go to the grocery store, you know, and I'm in my sweats and my sweatshirt because I'm so happy that I don't have to be dressed up on my day off. And people will come up and say, "You do your own grocery shopping?" And I'm like, "Yep. That and my own laundry and my own running
around." I used
around.
To ask them if they wanted to do it for me.
It is funny. I mean, people think it's a very glamorous lifestyle. And I suppose in one way, you know, it is in terms of who you get to be around. And I mean, I think it's glamorous to be next to John Lewis, right, as an example. And but no, I mean, it's hard, you know, it's personally challenging. And if you do the job well, or if you want to do the job well, it is nonstop. And we have, you know, we have people say, "Oh, are you off this week from Congress because you're home in the district?" I'm like, what's off? There is no off. I come back and there's just tons of work to do in the district, meetings, things to go to, town halls to do, engaging with constituents. I love it. I really, really love it. Not because it's easy, not because it's not depressing, you know, especially at this time in history, but because it's consequential and because I get to use the platform to lift up stories that I think don't get to be told and issues that don't get to be seen. And I get to fight for the stuff I believe in. And, you know, and I get to put a face on what it means to be an immigrant in Congress, an immigrant woman of color in Congress.
Well, and some people will ask, and I think it is a challenge when you represent something like 735,000 people. In fact, most people don't get to meet their member of Congress, and so it can seem at quite a distance.
Yeah.
Tell me about how it is that you try to connect yourself to your constituents, to the people that you represent.
Well, that's the part I love the most is, you know, I think I've done something like 8 town halls. We Facebook live stream them. So we've had over 15,000 people participate in those. But then I also do, some of those are like, our first one was 1,000 people. But I also do these, I just started this series called Java with Jayapal. I was like, it could be Paratha with Pramila or Java with Jayapal. I think we'll go with Java with Jayapal. It's a way to lift up, you know, independent coffee shops around the district. So we go all around the district.
And your district has a lot of coffee shops.
A lot of coffee shops and, you know, a real opportunity to lift them all up. And we have anywhere from 30 to 70 people. It's really intimate settings. Two-thirds of most of those people have never been in a room with a member of Congress. So that's one way. A second way is we have a lot of focus on constituent services. We do a tremendous amount of work there. We've already gotten back over $350,000 for people across our district in six and a half months. And the consistent feedback I get about my staff and my offices is people are so nice. They listened to me. They helped me. You know, we've gotten immigration cases solved for people. We've done all kinds of great stuff that is one-on-one constituent services. And that word gets around really fast. So people come in, and even if they don't get to talk to me, they talk to a staff member, and it's very up close and personal. And then we do a lot of stuff on the campaign side as well. You know, we have hundreds of volunteers that work on a door knocking campaign on the unofficial side for candidates that I've endorsed, both around locally as well as nationally. And so we're constantly training, you know, constantly doing speeches. I'm constantly doing speeches and trying to get people engaged. And if, you know, that's always a fault of mine, as I have a hard time saying,
well,
no,
and in
I can't
a 2-year
do that.
In a 2-year term, I mean, I think this is one of the challenges. You serve for 2 years, but essentially that second year you begin running a campaign. Some people say it never stops, and there's a reason for that.
Yeah.
What do you think about, I mean, you have to spend a fair amount of time fundraising.
I do.
And some people would argue that that takes away from your ability
totally
to spend
agree.
Time with your constituents.
I totally agree. You know, I don't take corporate PAC money, so that's one thing that I didn't do during the campaign. I'm not doing it now. And so my campaign is entirely funded by individuals. During my last campaign, I think we had 82,000 people who supported me. And it was, you know, an average contribution of $23. So I always tease Bernie Sanders and, you know, like, I beat your 27. You know, I got 23. But I think that that's been really good for me in some ways. But it does mean I'm on, you know, phone calls all the time and trying to get the bigger donations as well as the smaller donations from individuals.
Do you think it's the best system?
I think the system we have is terrible. I think we should have a publicly funded system. I think that Citizens United is a disaster, but it goes beyond Citizens United. I mean, even before that.
And explain to some of our listeners who may not know what Citizens United is.
Well, Citizens United essentially said that corporations could put, and wealthy individuals could put enormous amounts of money into funding campaigns and never even disclose that they're doing that. And so what you have is increasingly these huge PACs that will fund a candidate or a campaign, as happened in your race, with independent expenditures, put tons of money into television advertising. And so now you have to worry. And even for me, you know, I just ran. But we have a lot of people who can throw down $1 million or $2 million immediately to self-fund their campaigns, plus have, you know, lots of wealthy individuals and corporations and the Koch brothers and others who put money into an independent PAC to also fund either for or against a candidate. So,
do you think that it's likely that we're going to get any kind of reform out of the Congress? Is that work that is actively ongoing?
It is work that's actively ongoing. In fact, John Sarbanes leads the Democracy Reform Task Force. I'm a vice chair of that. We have about 6 bills that we've put forward as ideas for how to reform the system. It's hard to imagine in this Congress making that happen. If Democrats take back the majority, I sure hope we do something around this.
But we've had examples in the past where Democrats have held the House, the
and haven't
Senate,
done anything.
And the
no,
presidency.
I'll tell you, that's one of my critiques. And I'm a Democrat, but it's one of my critiques is that we don't do enough good. When we do have power, we're too timid and too meek. We should have passed the Employee Free Choice Act. We should have passed democracy reforms around Citizens United. I don't know if we were actually in power at the time, but We were. Okay. She says, yes, you were there probably. but, you know, these are the $15 minimum wage. I mean, I was on the committee that passed a $15 minimum wage in Seattle. And when I went to the state Senate on my third day, I put forward a bill to just increase the wage to $12. And I couldn't get our whole caucus to sign on to it. And it was sort of held back. So, you know, we have to take our power and do something that differentiates ourselves from Republicans. Otherwise, people are going to say, why should I vote for you? I need somebody who's going to shake up the system like Donald Trump.
Well, so, I mean, you raise an issue because, and especially as a woman, there are a few women. How many women are there in that House? About 85 or so.
That sounds about right.
In the House, and then, you know, add a couple of dozen in the Senate, right, or a couple tens in the Senate.
Right.
But what that means is that if you want to push back against your own party, there are some disincentives to that. And so how do you navigate your ability to challenge within the party, but also to still work with it?
I think that's something I'm still trying to figure out. You know, I think I'm definitely a team player. I always have been. So I always try to work from within first to articulate what my issues are and my concerns are. But I also think that I represent 750,000 people. I have been very clear on my platforms, not all of which are endorsed by the Democratic caucus. You know, I am clear that I believe a single-payer system is the way that we should be going, and that Democrats need to do a lot more to address some of the gaps in the healthcare system. At the same time, acknowledging that and fighting for the Affordable Care Act because it expanded coverage for tens of millions of Americans. College for All, I've introduced a College for All bill. I think we should have free public education at our public universities and colleges. So I have a whole set of things that I believe we should be pushing for, and I'm going to continue to push for them and find the ways to challenge internally, but then also, if necessary, and if we were to get into power, it's a lot easier in some ways when you're not in power because everyone kind of coalesces around what they would do. The question is what happens when you're in power. And so we'll see. I think the real test will be coming if we were to take back the House in 2018. But even, you know, in terms of what we're saying to energize people to vote for Democrats in 2018, that's a bit of a struggle, as you can imagine.
So we're coming to the end of our discussion, and I wonder if you could share with our listeners your advice, particularly for young women, women of color, if they want to move forward in the leadership ranks.
Well, I'll say what I tweeted after Don Young called me on the floor, a young lady who didn't know a damn thing about what I was talking about. I tweeted out to women of color, I said, don't be patronized, don't be minimized, and let the small guys out there be intimidated by you. Because I think really our biggest problem as women of color is that we have had a history and all of the pictures are of women of color not exercising our natural leadership. And so my advice really is to be clear on who you are, to be humble always, but to not be afraid to show your strength and your power. And I think the rest of it comes along. I think I would also say, you know, work in issues that matter. Be grounded in what you believe and be grounded in the work. Don't think about who you want to be. Think about what you want to do. But be clear that you have something to offer and don't let anybody get you off that track.
Well, I am just blown away because I think that you have really hit the ground running in the Congress. Your leadership is, you know, going to be long lasting. And I just want to thank you very much for joining us. The fearless Congresswoman from the great state of Washington's 7th District, Pramila Jayapal. You've been listening to Donna Edwards at Woman to Woman. Let's Talk Leadership. This is our Brennan Center for Justice program, which you can catch on Facebook, Twitter, and all of our programs on YouTube, and listen to our iTunes podcast. All our reports are on our media website at brennancenter.org. Pramila Jayapal, thank you very much for
joining
us. Donna
Edwards, thank you for everything that you do and have inspired.